Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Victoria Malko, author of The Ukrainian Intelligentsia and Genocide, The Struggle for History, Language, and Culture in the 1920s and 1930s, published by Lexington Books in 2021. Victoria Malko is lecturer of American history at Fresno State University with teaching interest in modern Europe, U.S. history, women's history, and world history. Also, Dr. Malko is founding coordinator of Holodomor Studies Program. She has been serving on editorial board of American History and Politics peer-reviewed journal and advisory board of National Holodomor Genocide Museum in Kyiv. Hello, Victoria. Thank you so much for joining me today. And of course, congratulations on your publication.
Hello, Natalia. Thank you very much. And thank you for this opportunity to talk about my book.
Yes, of course. But I feel like congratulations remarks attained some new meaning after February 24th, when the Russian Federation attacked Ukraine. And I do believe that our conversation is quite pertinent today to the present moment, because many point out that the current war is some sort of continuation of what Russia has been doing for not just decades, but century. On the one hand, the idea was to convince the world that Ukrainians and Russians are quote-unquote one people, and on the other hand, to convince the Ukrainians that they do not exist. So would you comment a little bit on this connection between the Holodomor and the present moment?
Thank you, Natalia. This is a very insightful comment, and indeed, the Holodomor is the most central narrative issue that Ukraine had to analyze, to go through, to understand that the current Russian war is essentially the continuation of that ongoing Russian genocide, which means Russification, the denial that Ukraine has the right to exist, that Ukraine has its own history, that Ukraine has its own language, and the denial of the Holodomor as genocide is at the root of this current violence. And so to prevent this violence, Russia has to come to terms with acknowledging these historical injustice. All five acts of genocide in accordance with Article 2 of the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide do apply to the case of the Holodomor. This has been established by our legal scholars, including Volodymyr Vasilenko, Miroslav Antonovich, and all of these five apply to the current war in Ukraine, genocidal violence. Timothy Snyder mentioned it, Professor I believe Sanders, the British scholar. So people are killed just because they are Ukrainian. Conditions, the mental harm, the bodily harm, is caused to the victims. It was caused in the 1930s. And currently, my father is the victim of this violence. He escaped from Irpin, and he still suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder, and so are the women, the children in the besieged Mariupol. The conditions of life, incompatible, actually, the conditions created during the Holodomor, the artificial famine, the destruction, the deportations, the blacklisting, the confiscations of grain and everything edible, passport regime, ban on travel. So all of these created impossible conditions for people to survive. The same thing we witness now when humanitarian corridors are not allowed. When even the United Nations, the Red Cross, the international organizations are trying to at least negotiate the way for the people to escape. 10 million people have been already displaced, internally displaced, and probably half of those went to Poland, Hungary, Romania, Slovakia. As far as Italy, even has Britain and the United States. So in the 1930s, of course, the entire republic was essentially a ghetto where people could not escape. And so probably one third of the population perished at that time. And again, we see that many people die of hunger. So we call it the Holodomor, but it was much more larger. It was not just the famine, the artificial conditions of famine. This was a genocidal tactic to force people to surrender, to subjugate. And so, for example, my father, without food for 1 week, he suffered. He said he had to relearn, actually, how to refeed himself. And so then I imagine, okay, that's how people felt then. You know, if 1 week and 60 days in the besieged Mariupol, when people are cooking probably one can of food and distributing it and trying to, use a bit of it just to survive, or when famous artists died because of the lack of nutrition, lack of food. So we sort of now begin to understand how it felt like in the 1930s for the generation of our parents, our grandparents. They were traumatized by those experiences. And my father, he later remembered the famine of 1946, for example, when his mother walked to Western Ukraine to procure food. And so again, 1 week without food. And now in his 80s, relieving all that childhood traumas. So the Ukrainian people, I would call them like the Christ nation. They carry this cross of living and having the neighbor that for centuries, since the 12th century, has been trying to subjugate the Ukrainians. And at the same time, they have very little understanding by the rest of the world of their own history. And so it appears like, the war out of a sudden for the NATO expansion. And they try to explain, no, this is not just about NATO. This has deeper historical, cultural roots. The eradication of the Ukrainian nation, the Russification, something that clearly meets the criteria of genocide. And just to mention two more, preventing births within the group. It happened then. The birth rate dropped significantly. We know, especially for women of the childbearing age in 1932, 1933, sometimes even there is no statistics to tell us how drastically that the birth rate dropped. But just indirectly, we know that one third of the population perished. And then currently we observe the same thing. Maternity hospitals are bombed or shelled indiscriminately. So these are not the headquarters of any military. This is the visible eradication of and depriving the nation of its future. And another topic of rape as a weapon of war. Unfortunately, there is no international court to prosecute such crimes. And we know that it happened in Bosnia, it happened in Rwanda, and we know in Kyiv, north of Kyiv, 25 women were held in a jail and raped systematically. Children were raped. So this is... these are genocidal acts, and they have to be prosecuted. And finally, the transfer of children. In the 1930s, children, where did they come? Homeless children, because their parents were exiled, arrested, executed. And so the whole generation of these children well-to-do, Ukrainian farmers ended up on the streets. And many of them then were collected, herded to children's homes or communes. And the very famous commune, headed by Anton Makarenko, a kind of a Russified Ukrainian. And it was under the, watchful eyes of the GPU. And so they were educated in Russian. Names of these children were changed. Skripnik's son, after Skripnik committed suicide, and Skripnik was commissar of education, one of the most sort of nationalist communists who, although supported Stalin in his fight with the opposition, the most capable Ukrainian who attended most of the communist conferences and forums, and who actually brought Ukrainization and brought many Western Ukrainians to revise and essentially issue the new Ukrainian orthography. And although he was a good communist, all the evils of Ukrainization were blamed on him, and he thought he could combine communist and nationalist ideologies, and obviously this clash of two ideologies led to eventual crisis, and he committed suicide. His young wife was run over by a truck. We know how KGB or GPU in those days could stage such incidents. And so his young son then became an orphan. And of course they changed his name because it was too obvious. Many of the names were nicknames or sometimes even listed as nevidomy. I saw one of the documents Professor Trehichuk showed me. He found in the archives Vanya Nevidomy. And it was a state-run orphanage named after Petrovsky. Mm. So how can you explain when the Soviet leaders tell the children are our future? And at the same time, the reality was quite the opposite. So these children died, sometimes as unknown. Sometimes it was changed names, like Lesya Ukrainka or Bernard Shaw, for example, when he visited the Soviet Union. And currently we see that children are also deported. So This is clearly a violation of the convention, and these children, sometimes from orphanages, perhaps from hospitals. First, I saw reports of tens of thousands, but now even the Russian sources tell us about 100,000 of nearly a million of deported Ukrainians are somewhere in Russia. And how do we, you know, get them back? So deportations, this is definitely the transfer of children from one national group to another, re-educating them in Russian, and forcing them to forget their language, their history, their families. So that is the, you know, the Russification that is at the very core of this genocidal policy. And of course, in the 1930s, it was disguised as, you know, a struggle with Ukrainian nationalists or bourgeois nationalists. And so now they call them Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, they called historians even fascist historians. Of course, it was 1930s. And in 1934, even Hrushevsky and Hermeisze, they were called Ukrainian fascists. And I saw this in one of the documents in the regional archives, published later probably in Yuri Mitzik's or in some other. It was a published source, not that I found it. I only worked in the central archives. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to travel to regional archives, but the Institute for the Study of the Holodomor in Kyiv, Ukraine, affiliated with the National Holodomor Genocide Museum, has researchers who travel to Ukrainian regional archives and bring all those documents, compile them, analyze to expand our understanding of what actually transpired in the regions in Ukraine in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Victoria. Thank you for enumerating these parallels between the present moment and the 1930s. And I do hope these parallels will be further discussed and studied in a detailed way, and I hope that this discussion will somehow shed some light on how the current war became possible and how the atrocities which are committed by Russian troops today in Ukraine also became possible. You also started talking a little bit about the origins of the Holodomor, and that's where I would like to take our conversation further at this moment. So your book discusses in detail the origins of the Holodomor, which to Anglophone audiences is known as the Great Famine of 1932-1933. You discuss the origins in connection with a systematic and systemic policy of the Soviet Union that was specifically targeted not only against the Ukrainian farmers who resisted the collectivization, but also against the Ukrainian intelligentsia, which you call the soul of the nation. One of the main arguments of your book is that the communist regime led by Stalin undertook well-calculated measures to eliminate the intelligentsia in Ukraine in order to minimize national aspirations, which started to intensively develop again in Ukraine in the 1920s, partially as a result of Ukrainization, which you already mentioned to some extent. So would you briefly reconstruct this trajectory that takes us from the formation of the USSR to the Holodomor, and why the intelligentsia was given so much attention while these developments were taking place?
Oh, this is a huge question. I think there are two approaches to the analysis of the causes of the Holodomor. And if we start with the definition and the law of on the Holodomor, it is called the Holodomor of 1932-33. And so this is a narrow interpretation of the Holodomor, and it is the legal definition, and it is the one that meets the definition of genocide. I look at it in a broader, kind of as a broad concept, and these two are not contradictory. Mm-hmm. So Miroslava Antonovich states in her research that both narrow and broad definitions apply to the case of the Holodomor. And why I approach it from the broader perspective, because that is the conceptualization that was presented by Lemkin himself. And we didn't know about it until 2008 when it was published. How ironic, he presented this speech in 1953. And so there were many, there were thousands of Ukrainians, and I'm sure there were scholars like Robert Conquest, who mentioned genocide. He equivocated on it a bit, but he didn't provide any citation to Lemkin and his speech in New York in 1953 on September 20th. And so that was puzzling. And even if we read reports about Lemkin's speech, we still did not get it from the reports by journalists that he actually presented the entire concept of his four-pronged attack in this, what he called Soviet genocide. And thanks to Roman Serbin, a professor of history from the University of Montreal, in 2010, he wrote an article where he tried to grapple and tried to understand how do we transition from this concept of just great famine to actually understand what was what were the acts of genocide that were committed. Because if we just look at collectivization and industrialization, this is not the main cause. We know that totalitarian regimes and even democracies, they do rely on, you know, strong economies, centralized economies, and they do have the strong military-industrial complex. So these are not the distinguishing characteristics. What distinguishes totalitarian regimes is one-party system and ideology. The system of terror, psychological terror, physical terror, and mass propaganda, control of the media. So we need to focus on those. And so those who conceptualize Holodomor as famine look at the causes, you know, look at collectivization, industrialization. But the Soviet Union, like, you know, the United States and like other, you know, democracies at that time also needed to survive economically. So I argue along with, you know, other scholars that economic reasons and causes were not the main ones. We need to look at the nationality policy that behind this veneer of Marxist internationalism was essentially Russian chauvinism, denationalization of all the other national groups, and especially Ukrainians, who were the largest of all the minority groups in the former Russian Empire and later the Soviet Empire that Lenin and later Stalin were building. And so when I looked at Lemkin's conceptualization, It took me several kind of presentations, and probably by May 2018, when I presented my talk at the Association for the Study of Nationalities, on the eve of that presentation, I reread again Lemkin's four-page essay, And it dawned upon me that he truly explained that it is not a famine or the famine. It is genocide, the Russification. And so, and he clearly stated, so the first prong of the attack was actually aimed at intelligentsia because they were the brain of the nation. And he pointed out that it all started in the 1920s, immediately when the Bolsheviks, on the third attempt, took over Ukraine. Because as Lenin said, we cannot lose Ukraine. Ukraine was the breadbasket of the Russian Empire. And so Bolsheviks needed bread to feed their proletariat, right? Because they didn't produce, right? So proletariat in Petrograd, in Moscow. And so they recognized the Ukrainian National Republic, right? You remember in December of 2017. And then in that same ultimatum, they threatened the Ukrainian National Republic and they moved their forces. So the Red Army marched into Ukraine. So on the third attempt. And if you read Lenin's thesis on the Russian Communist Party's policy toward Ukraine, those theses were drafted in November of 1919. And so there are probably 9 items there. And so number one, that Ukraine for now should be kept kind of as a republic, but then eventually submerged by Russian Republic. So, and then special care given to the nationalist sentiments in Ukraine. And what he meant by that, studying the Ukrainian language. So as Petlura later said, so that the brothers who confiscate all our riches and treasures do not look like they are conquerors, but that they are our own brothers, quote unquote. And so it was very instrumental. So the learning, the requirement to learn Ukrainian for the officials who were sent to Ukraine was just instrumental. It was not as it was interpreted the way to give Ukrainians a sort of a sense of their national identity or anything else. It was very instrumental. And we know that many of the Russian officials who were in charge of Ukraine, including the military and all the administrative offices and Soviets, they didn't bother even to learn Ukrainian. And we know this. Although there were tests that required the study of the language, they found a way to bypass, evade, and essentially they didn't bother to study Ukrainian. Other items on that agenda were to disarm Ukraine. And we see this quite clearly now. And Stalin did. He followed that very same policy. So the Red Terror of 1917 to 1921 essentially swept Ukraine, all the countryside, all the weapons, guns, sabers, anything. Everything was confiscated. And I think Petro Grigorenko wrote about this in his memoirs. I think Dmitro Solovey, he even presented statistics on exactly how many sabers and pistols and whatnot, all the firearms, even cannons, whatnot. So everything was confiscated. And then Stalin did the same when they registered the firearms and in 1926, 1928, 1929, before they implemented this special operation that was the Holodomor of 1932 that started in November. And so that was the policy that was very systematically followed to disarm Ukraine, something that we hear now, Putin's call to demilitarize Ukraine, right? Calling special operation, indeed, the Holodomor was a special operation because it was planned by the security services, by the GPU, with the support of the military. They always had their own military detachments, the security services, plus, of course, he could use the Red Army. So this is the pattern of this same imperial policy, beginning from Lenin to Stalin to Putin. And so Lenin, of course, did not create Ukraine, as Putin claims, but he just couldn't let it go because of its riches. And he always called for more bread and more bread and more bread from Ukraine. And as Schlichter reported, that every grain that wheat collected in Ukraine was soaked in blood. So I read his article. So going on down the list on Lenin's theses, Ukrainian intelligentsia had to be co-opted. And he singled out Spilka, teachers' union, and particularly wrote that it has to be just liquidated. And so 1 year later in 1920, it was liquidated. So there was no more Ukrainian teachers' union. It became known as ROBOS, which is something like an equivalent of educational employees union. And that was under total Russian Communist Party control. So it was not an independent trade union by no means. And of course, recruiting half of the population into Soviets, that is exactly the genocidal policy, because you recruit the local population to implement your colonial policy. So all these people later participated in grain requisitions campaigns, in all the propaganda campaigns, in collectivization campaigns. We know the numbers range like in 30% or something, but Lenin stated it very clearly. Recruit half of the population into local Soviets. That's it. That's the language. And so that's what Putin is doing. He is trying to find local collaborators, useful assets among the local population who would collaborate with the regime. And again, he targets the leaders, right, the mayors. And in Melitopol, even the teachers. So I read one of the reports recently that in April, the first days of April, the authorities, the Russian authorities, forced all the directors of schools to switch to Russian and offer programs in Russian. And of course, all the teachers, all the directors refused. They signed letters of resignation. And the representative of the opposition, which is the party of the opposition, and they, of course, found the person willing to take upon the role of a temporary kind of authority. She threatened the teachers. She said that they will not receive humanitarian aid. And worst of all, they went house to house, knocked on the doors, and all of these directors were herded on a bus, shipped 30 kilometers outside Melitopol, and then let go home on foot. So this is the kind of the incarnation of these Russian policies of instilling their own language, their own culture, just switching to their own education. And again, we see that members of the intelligentsia are the first targets of their policy because they are the brain of the nation. And of course, by then, second target group were the clergy of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which was independent. Now we call them autocephalous. It has its own right to sort of govern itself and being independent from the Moscow Patriarchy. All the clergy that in 1921 had their church council in St. Sophia in Kyiv. Most of them by 1930s were either arrested or exiled, executed. Lipkivsky also died somewhere outside Kyiv. Leontovich was murdered. Stetsenko, Kirill Stetsenko, who wrote some of the probably the best national liturgical works, those were purged after he died of cholera, I believe, or typhus. But the Gipu were after him. So he was hiding, contracted typhus, and then died at the age of 41. He is the one who wrote the Panahida, the Ukrainian Requiem, and the best liturgical works that we did not even know about. And all his collected works were published only in 2013. So such a huge, colossal cultural loss to generations of Ukrainians. Again, the church was liquidated, right? So that's the second group. And then the sons and daughters of the clergy were just deprived of even higher education. And so they were outside the law. The entire kind of social strata were declared parasites, essentially. And we know that in Ukraine, most of the teachers were the sons and daughters of the clergy. They were, literate. They could sing. They knew the Ukrainian language. So that was the soul of the nation, essentially, the spirit of the nation. And then the third prong of the attack was against the Ukrainian independent farmers. I do not call them peasants because that's a medieval concept, and although it is translated as such, but it does not represent the modern day kind of entrepreneurial spirit of Ukrainian homesteads that were selling grain on international markets before the revolution. And Lenin, of course, just destroyed the economy along with that tradition of independent farming. And so that is where the difference is between the narrow and the broad definition of the Holodomor as genocide. So it seemed like most of the Ukrainians were farmers, as they argue, or the farmers were mostly Ukrainians. And so, yes, in the 1930s, 80% probably of the world population were living in rural areas. But that doesn't mean that there were no intelligentsia in Ukraine at that time. They were a tiny probably percentage, but they were eliminated in proportionally speaking in larger numbers than even the farming population. Because if we compare what James Mace wrote, that the Ukrainian intelligentsia virtually were wiped out. So, and I saw some of the percentages, like 70% or 80% of Western Ukrainian intelligentsia. And if we compare to the losses, relative losses among the farming populations, even if we say 5 million out of 25 million, and 10 million probably is more reasonable to assume, counting, you know, people that were not only working on the land, but also the clergy, the intelligentsia. And so that only gives us like 25 to 30% of the farming population. And so you compare 70% to 30%, then the losses among the intelligentsia were much more significant. Although numerically, they were probably not as, not in millions, but probably in tens of thousands. And even to that point, how many members of the intelligentsia actually were the victims of the Holodomor? I found out that the GPU even did not tally all these numbers. So, for example, Nikolev, he studied like 27, 1928, 1929, 1930, 31, 32, 33. So he found like for 1930, especially when all these, the countryside was inflamed with the uprisings, about 1 million people, like 4,000 uprisings. And at that time, there's just no, completely, the statistics is just sanitized from their data. So in 29, we know that there was a very large number of arrested members of intelligentsia. And then 32, 33, again, we see another gap in numbers. And they even didn't count teachers as a separate category. I only saw probably for 1932, for just for 1 year out of these 27, 28, 29, only 1 year that they counted teachers as a separate category, and probably a few hundred, so like 800 or something. So overall, when I looked at these categories, and Nikolev concluded that if we look at 14 different social categories, the intelligentsia were on the top. They were the first. So clearly during the Holodomor, the intelligentsia were targeted the most. So repressions, arrests, executions. In terms of the numbers, I don't know. I saw 30,000 arrested in 1 year alone following the SVU trial. But then when I computed Nikolev's numbers, that gave me 30,000 as well. So I'm not sure where historians take their numbers. Nikolev probably was more conservative because he just followed the GPU documents. And Yuri Shapoval, he probably wrote it. He's a very good storyteller. So probably he just used the combined number for emphasis. But I found also that we can estimate the number of teachers that disappeared kind of from the ranks when we look at the statistical tables. And those, fortunately, were published in 1935. So we need to give credit to Alexander Satkin, who was later, of course, executed for allegedly, quote unquote, falsifying statistics because he didn't show up that there were enough Ukrainians. So he was the one who actually alerted the authorities in 1935 that there is a strange demographic phenomenon going on, that there are lots of losses among the Ukrainian population. And so 2 years later, you know, he was executed. Because instead of 35 million, there were probably 28 or 29 million Ukrainians. So there was a gap of 7.1 million. And that's, I think, Vasil Marochko. He studied the protocol of the interrogation. And that's the number that is just stated on paper. So that's a historical document. It's not a demographic estimate or anything like that. So sometimes it is criticized because this is just, 35 minus 28, 29 million. So demographers disagree with that number. But nevertheless, that is what Asatkin and other demographers also projected. That was a projected kind of number that Ukraine didn't reach, obviously, because of 1932-33. And so in that, that's kind of the economic handbook that presented the developments in the Republic in all spheres of economic activity, including education, because number one, primary education was compulsory. And so all the directors of schools were required to submit their monthly reports about the enrollments. And so that you know, and demographers, ironically, they have that document because Natalia Levchuk, when I met with her at that conference, ASN conference, that's one of the advantages of actually going to this conference is because you have a chance to speak even to your adversaries, the people with whom you disagree, but they share the resources. So, and because it's a published source and it is not a statistical source, although those are statistical tables, they have never used those. They just, demographers use only census statistics, period. And they know that it exists. She actually sent this PDF document to me, and they studied these tables. This is fascinating. It is so detailed for all the regions, rayone, district levels. And so I was able to actually figure out, and from various tables, there is in particular one, students, schools, and teachers. And from 1914 to 1917, all the way to 1935, year by year. And when I looked just at the primary schools, if you look at the overall, the impression is, oh yeah, the growth and the numbers for the students and teachers and schools. But if you look very carefully and just focus on the primary schools, and we know that those were number one, obligatory, all children were required, and number two, the highest percentage of deaths occurred among the children of primary schools because of their age. And so if we just focus on these primary schools, we see very clearly that there is a sharp drop that is unaccounted for. And even the compilers, they just list very honestly all these numbers, but they do not provide any explanation of what happens. They just say, well, perhaps because of the restructuring of the schools or something. But we know that if there were six schools, for example, like in Radomysl, that the city that I focused on, out of six schools in 1927, by 1934, only two schools remained. School number one, named after Taras Shevchenko, and school number two, named after Lenin. Kind of match, one-to-one. Here is communist, here is nationalist, right? Tradition. And so we know that the number of schools dropped. So restructuring of schools was not obviously the reason of why the number of students dropped. And I also noticed that if we look at 1914 and then look at this number in 1934, and I provide this table in my book, the only table that the editor allowed. He vetoed all the other tables. He said, readers are not interested in tables. They cannot interpret them. Just minimize it. You know, he allowed me a certain minimum number of photographs and tables. So in that table, it clearly shows that the number, 20 years of Soviet rule, resulted in the eradication of the students and teachers and schools. So there were less schools in Ukraine if we compare in before the revolution. So these are the consequences of mm-hmm. the 20 years of Soviet rule, of the Russian mm-hmm. Occupation of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So that is, you know, these were kind of very insightful findings that, you know, I came up with after, you know, working and writing this this book.
Well, thank you, Victoria, for this conversation. And again, congratulations on your book. And thank you for advancing the Holodomor studies and for drawing attention to the Holodomor on the international level, because I still believe that the Holodomor, unfortunately, is quite invisible on the global mental and memory map at this moment. And we need to talk more about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Natalia. Thank you for this opportunity.
Today, I spoke with Victoria Malko, author of The Ukrainian Intelligentsia and Genocide, The Struggle for History, Language, and Culture in the 1920s and 1930s, published by Lexington Books in 2021. Thank you for listening to New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.